Okay, thank you all so much for joining us here for our event today. Many of you have been frequent attenders at Yevgenia's new series that she's been running this year for us. And today we don't have a guest for the event, for the series, and instead we're going to hear from Zhenya today on her reflections about her relationship and about the career and the life of Alexander Navalny. And it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you here to this event today. My name is Joshua Tucker. I'm the director of the Jordan Center. And I would like to introduce our speaker today. For those of you who don't know her, Yevgenia Albets is a Russian investigative journalist, political scientist, author, and radio host. Since getting her PhD in political science from Harvard University, keeping our tradition of having multiple classmates of hers at our events here today, we've got another one in the back of the room, she's been sharing her life between academia and journalism. She's been editor-in-chief of the political weekly The New Times since 2007 and a talk show host of Absolute Albets at the Russian version of NPR, Echo Moscow, until it was taken off the air 5 days after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. She has been accused of being a foreign agent working on behalf of Ukraine and convicted for spreading disinformation about Russian armed forces for her coverage of the war in Ukraine, and she was forced to leave Russia at the end of August 2022. She came to the United States at that point again, after having been here many times before, and she taught at NYU from 2022 to 2023, and then was a media and democracy fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and a fellow at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Beginning this autumn, she's a research professor with the Department of Russian and Slavic Studies here at NYU, and she's working on her new book project. It is my great pleasure to welcome her here today. So please join me in that.
Thank you very much, Josh. And I'm very grateful to the Jordan Center for Advanced Study of Russia because not many places in this country and across the globe are interested in things Russian, understandably so, because we're now the aggressor nation and we're killing people in a sovereign country for no reason whatsoever. Ukrainians never attacked us, never did any bad to us. We just decided, not we. Putin just decided that Ukraine doesn't exist. Ukrainians non-existent people. They're part of, they're sort of, not exactly, same as Russians, but sort of half Russians or stuff like that. Anyway, so I'm very grateful to Jordan Center, to the Department of Russian and Slavic Studies, and to NYU for hosting me. Today I'm going to talk about Alexei Navalny. We know each other, or we knew each other since 2004, and we were in close correspondence all the way until he was killed in the Arctic penal colony Harp in February 2024, 2 years ago. I got his last message from Harp, and then on February 9th, and several days later he was killed. Putin killed Navalny. It's no longer speculation. Before we used to say Putin allegedly killed Navalny. No longer. This conclusion was reached by laboratories in five countries, including the United Kingdom and Sweden and etc. Their statements say that the Russian opposition leader and prisoner of special regime colony number three, Polar Wolf, located 60 kilometers above the Arctic Circle, was killed by poison from the Ecuadorian frog. This was established on the basis of an examination of biological material taken from Navalny's body and removed from Russia. You can find details, but Russians managed to synthesize this poison. Of course, they didn't bring frogs from Ecuador, more so since it's not frogs themselves, but their skin that accumulates this poison, and there are no antidotes, or at least we don't know about that. And the specialists in the chemical in the Russian chemical weapons, one of them, Dr. Mirzoyev, who is who was involved in production of chemical weapons in the Soviet Union, he confirmed that most likely that it was already that it was known that Russians were working on synthesizing this poison, and it looks like they succeeded. The murder in Kharkiv was at least the third attempt to poison Navalny, which unfortunately was successful. The first time he was poisoned in 2017 in the jail, but they clearly miscalculated the dose. The second time it was in the Moscow jail. The second time it was in August 2020, but Navalny was lucky. His wife managed to take him on a private medical plane to a clinic in Berlin, and the German Bundeswehr had samples of the latest versions of Russian chemical weapons of mass destruction, which the Russian didn't know about, but which made it possible to save Navalny. Novichok, that's the weapon of mass destruction, a chemical weapon. It has several interactions, several weapons. Original Novichok was created in order to use at the battlefield. There is a place, in Saratov Oblast. It's called Shekhany. It's been very well known as the place where Soviet and Russian chemical weapons were developed. Of course, Russian Federation joined the convention which prohibited creating chemical weapons and using chemical weapons. And Mr. Putin himself several times said that, that Russia eliminated all storage of chemical weapons. Obviously, it did not. Russians kept developing this Novichok poison, and the one that was used, the version that was used to poison Navalny, it happened, in the Siberian city Tomsk. It was the new one, and Russians were absolutely aware that nobody had any traces of these Novichok, no samples. If you don't have samples, you cannot make antidote. The second thing, which was important, that Russian scientists believed, and this was KGB scientists, of course, scientists, they believed that any traces of Novichok were to evaporate from Navalny's body in a matter of 48 hours. Once again, they turned out to be wrong because Bundeswehr, German army, has a very, very, very developed machines capable to not just to trace whatever left in the body from Novichok, but also they had the sample and they were able to make an antidote. That's why Navalny survived. Antidote, is it the same in English? Yeah, okay. So that's why, he was survived. And so on February 16th, 2024, Putin's agents came about with the synthesized neurotoxin epibatidine. Anyway, Navalny died in agony. We have pictures of him from his cell. He was asking for a doctor. Nobody, of course, no doctor was found. He was laying on the floor, vomiting and in convulsions. It was a very, very hard death. Of course, it is. Of course, there is a question: why Putin? Why Putin's agents were so eager to kill Navalny? Why did they do it? And we have to give Putin one credit: his acute instinct for self-preservation and his keen sense of who his enemies are. Alexei Navalny was such an enemy, capable of taking power away from the Russian dictator. Much has been written. This is the cover of New Times, of my magazine, many years ago, I think 2017, something like that. Much has been written about the successful Navalny, how successful Navalny was as a street politician, how politically astute he was in building his anti-Putin campaign on exposing the corruption and the theft of the elite, and finally how his unparalleled courage and his famous appeal from the prison, "I am not afraid, and you shouldn't be afraid, too," struck at the very foundation of Putin's regime, which is based on fear. The fear of both ordinary citizens and the nomenklatura of searches, arrests, and prison. Looking back, one realizes that his life, Navalny's life, at least since 2012, when he was recognized by the broader public as a potential future president and as a hope of the Russian opposition, became a cycle of endless arrests, trials, and imprisonment. In 2013, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison on completely fabricated charges in the so-called Kirovlev case, which didn't even involve a junior financial investigation, but relied essentially on the testimony of a single individual. That's Navalny in Kirov, in this case. In December 2014 came another case. The Yves Rocher affair. Yves Rocher is a big French company, cosmetic company, which somehow accused a company which was run by Navalny's brother, Oleg, that they created problems for their business. There was nothing was n there was no no proof no any any expertise brought, and later after that, in a couple of months, Yves Rocher wrote a letter saying that they are not accusing brothers Navalny's in anything. They didn't do any bad. However, what happened was that the head of Yves Rocher in Moscow, he was a gay. And in Russia back already, it was a little bit difficult to be a queer person. So he was somehow blackmailed, and he was pressed to bring these charges to the Procurator General. And that's how the whole case originated. Then he left Russia. He returned back to France. He no longer lives in France. He went somewhere in South America. We have been writing about that, many, many articles about that. But that was the case. Navalny received a suspended sentence of 3.5 years, while his younger brother, Oleg Navalny, this is Oleg before jail. In jail and when he was released. His younger brother, Oleg Navalny, was sentenced to 3.5 years in penal colony, much of which he spent in a solitary confinement. For Alexei, this was unbearable. He understood that Oleg had been imprisoned because of him, that the authorities had jailed his younger brother, whom he felt it was his duty to protect, leaving behind a wife and two small children. Then, in 2020, the year Putin staged the constitutional coup, rewrote the constitution, and effectively secured the presidency for life, Navalny was poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent from the Novichok group. He survived, recovered. That was the day when he came out of the coma. He couldn't speak. He didn't understand who was surrounding him. He couldn't walk, of course. He couldn't eat. Everything that's, unfortunately, the nature of Novichok poison that it creates some unbearable things to people's to person's nervous system. Navalny survived, recovered, returned to Russia, and was imprisoned again, this time for good. That's Alexei. He flew by the Russian airline called Pobeda Victory. Hundreds of thousands of people were meeting him in Moscow. Russians diverted the plane from Vnukovo Airport, where it was supposed to land, to Sheremetyevo, so that people who were meeting him in Vnukovo Airport were unable to meet him at the Sheremetyevo Airport, and he was immediately arrested. He was arrested. He didn't even cross the border. Border troops arrested him right away. That's when he was arrested. Looking at Navalny, Putin confronted something deeper. A figure, not just, his political rival, not just political opponent, but a figure who embodied many of the qualities he himself had once dreamed of possessing but never did. I love this picture. This is Putin. Vova. He was called Vova. This is Mr. Sobchak, the first democratically elected mayor of Leningrad and St. Petersburg. And this is Mr. Putin, his assistant. And the KGB guy who returned back from Dresden, where he was on assignment from the personal department. Putin never was a spy. He never was part of the Soviet intelligence. He returned back to Leningrad. He didn't get any decent job. So the only job that he was able to get was assistant to the dean of the Leningrad State University. That was the kind of jobs that burned down spies usually got. In intelligence department, now it's called SVR. Then it was the first main directorate. I spoke to the head of the then head of the first main directorate. He refused to take him because he was too bad at his job. And Putin started in the ideological counterintelligence. He was searching for dissidents. His job was to put down, to cheat on foreign correspondents. That's all this kind of dirty tricks that they usually do. So if you look at them, you can see how why Putin was so envy of Navalny. Navalny was tall and handsome. Navalny was charming with his stunning white tooth smile. Putin had the small features of a commoner, expressionless eyes, and the ability not so much to attract as to recruit. Navalny had a stunning wife. Navalny had a stunning wife and a large, close-knit family, while Putin's personal life was a mess. Navalny could talk to people from all walks of life and inspire them. While Putin had to coerce or pay his supposed supporters to attend his rallies, Navalny was well read and loved, especially by young Russians, while Putin's main electorate in 2008 was women aged 64 plus and living in small towns and villages. It may seem that Navalny has always been the way he is, but in fact, he has worked incredibly hard on himself and studied a lot. I met him first in the summer of 2004. After defending my doctoral dissertation at Harvard, I returned to Moscow and was immediately hired as a professor at the High School of Economics in the Political Science Department, where I then taught institutional theory of the state and the history of Tsarist, Soviet, and Russian bureaucracy and the theory of political regimes. I taught it for 7 years. Politics was stagnant at the time, and Democrats were now enamored with Putin. His 13% flat tax reform, his attack on the oligarchs, and finally his youth, especially in comparison to the sick and heavy drinking Yeltsin, all that was very attractive. As a result, the Democratic parties lost their parliamentary elections and went back to their usual business, fighting among themselves. Both Yabloko, it's a social democratic party, and the Union of Right Forces, it is something like, a little bit on the right. It's very difficult with respect to Russian, Josh knows this better than anybody else. It's very difficult to assign, left, right, to Russian politics, but it's very, very, sort of, different in a way. So Union of Right Forces, they were in terms of, they were for deregulation, for less state and more, business, but at the same time, they were supporters of civil rights and rights to queer people and rights to any minorities existed in Russia, etc. So, but all these, parties on the democratic side of the Russian political spectrum, they had youth factions. Observing them, especially the then prominent leader of Оборона and, and some others, I invited young leaders and activists from various democratic groups, from Yabloko and Union of Right Forces, members of Christian Democrats, Baptists, and even National Bolsheviks of Eduard Livonov's. So I invited them to my weekly dinner to discuss grassroots politics and collective action. Navalny was the oldest among them. My idea was that since we have oligarchical politics in Russia, it is vitally important for us to learn to work together, to engage in campaigning and fundraising, appealing to those who supported us. And that is exactly what we did. We began organizing rallies under the slogan, "I am free," and under the auspices of the movement's defense, yes, I think, and etc., based on a song that was popular at the time. Now, it was exactly, the first, slogan of the song, "I'm free," and that's what we were playing in front of Lubyanka every other month. Lubyanka, that's the place where KGB and now FSB is located, and also on the other side, close by the buildings of the now presidential administration and the Soviet time Central Committee of the Communist Party. So we were organizing those rallies, and Navalny was exceptionally good when he went door to door, and he was so natural. People of all ages, preoccupied with their daily concerns, listened to him, asked him for advice, trusted him. But he still had a long way to go. I remember how in 2005 we held a rally in Moscow in defense of freedom of speech. I looked at Navalny from the crowd. He was on stage leading the rally together with another member of the group, and in several years he became, investigative reporter at New Times, and then he was deported. At the request of Igor Sechin, one of the most powerful guy in Russia, de facto owner of the Rosneft, the biggest company in the world, oil company in the world. It's a Russian, a state-owned company. So I was watching them and I thought, wow, such a handsome guy, but he has no idea how to speak to crowd. And Navalny taught himself to speak from the stage. I don't know how. I don't know if he ever took lessons, but he taught himself, and that's how he taught himself everything. Navalny's uniqueness for Russia lay in the fact that he consciously and professionally prepared himself for the position of president of the country, the leader of a democratic Russia. Putin's harsh regime, which constantly arrested Navalny or placed him under house arrest, played a significant role in this. Navalny used his time in prison as a place for his political education. He set himself at least three major goals. One, learn how to win elections by drawing on the experience of Western politicians and understand why politicians lose elections. Understand how and in what combination to offer political goods to potential voters, how to combine populism, which is inevitable in a politically unstructured country such as Russia, with adherence to one's principles, how to talk to different audiences, from grandmothers in country yards, who are always the most active voters, to young people who are much more interested in video games than in politics. The second goal was to understand how the political machines of parties and democracies, primarily in the United States, are structured. How are institutions built? In what sequence? Considering that after Putin, everything would have to start from scratch. Third, to study countries that could be potential allies and foes of Russia. He set himself tasks and followed through on them. For instance, during his very successful campaign for the mayor of Moscow, he used a lot of instruments. That's his, one of the pictures from this campaign. He used a lot of instruments he picked up from different TV series. He told me back then in the interview, quote, "All my meetings with voters are like in TV series The Wire, which incidentally is Obama's favorite series. These are episodes, the third and part of the fourth season of The Wire, where the Baltimore mayoral elections takes place. That's exactly what these meetings look like," Navalny said. In the series House of Cards, for example, there is an episode where one of the characters meets with voters. There, I saw chairs for elderly people who came to the meeting, and that's exactly what he did. He was the very first. It's never ever happened. You think it's so simple. People come to your rally, during election campaign, and in Russia, you stand everywhere, in church, except for the synagogue, but in and during the rallies, so he brought all these chairs. So he asked to bring chairs for each and every of his meetings with people, and he had three meetings per day. I remember when he called me once during this campaign and said, "Shania, I'm so tired. I cannot do it anymore." And he had a very, very good logistics and a very good campaign manager, Leonid Volkov. And he said, "Can you call Volkov and ask him maybe, he can, reduce." And so I called Volkov. I said, "What are you doing, Leonia? What are you doing, with Alexei? He's exhausted." And I remember how Volkov responded to me saying, "If he wants to be a mayor of Moscow, he has to do it." And he kept doing three meetings a day. Something he picked up from the series Homeland. Other stuff he learned from his studies at Yale University. Navalny was a World Fellow at Yale University in 2010. Once again, he told me, quote, "For example, we had a meeting there with Howard Dean, who was then head of the Democratic National Committee. He said that during an election campaign, 30% of your time is spent meeting with voters and 70% is spent on the phone asking for money. Talking to American politicians, I realized that elections are simply hard work for the candidate and his staff, and that our election campaigns, which I build on PR people and technology, are nonsense," end of quote. Navalny's 2013 mayor's campaign was the very first grassroots campaign ever in Russia. Navalny was endlessly placed in temporary detention sentence. In 2 years, according to his colleagues' calculations, he spent more than 300 days in what is called EVS. EVS is a jail for for short sentences, for 10 weeks, 10 days, 2 weeks, 30 days. And it's much easier to be there, in terms of how we can, the possibility to bring food, to bring some important things. You could take a shower, I think, twice a week, whereas in jail only once a week. So in 2014 he was placed under house arrest and used these months to educate himself in political science, a field that, like sociology, didn't exist in the Soviet Union. And Navalny had nowhere to take courses on bureaucracy or institution building. I visited him and Yulia in their small two-room apartment on the outskirts of Moscow, called Marina, during his house arrest. There was an entrance hall that served as a living and dining room. A treadmill was in the corner. Navalny was not allowed to jog outside. Opposite the treadmill was a bookcase. There was a pile of thick volumes in English, books on political philosophy, governance, the structure of regimes and institutions of power, and memoirs of politicians. And by the way, Sergei Gurev was one of his major advisors on all books in economics. During this year, Navalny took courses that required from graduate students at Harvard University. By the way, in their apartment in Mariina, the kitchen window overlooked the house across where the KGB had bought or rented an apartment and from which they monitored Navalny and his family 24/7. 24/7. There is a spe it's very easy technique. You can read in many books how you do it. You screen the windows and you get the information, everything what is happening inside the apartment. But also, of course, there were video cameras from the top apartments. So these two young people, whether they were making love or taking a shower or playing with their kids, they were under constant surveillance. The authorities loved to conduct searches at his house. That's, for instance, one of the searches in his house. Turning his and Yuli's apartment upside down, taking away the children's iPods and iPads, and rummaging through their personal belongings. I often sent him books to prison until his colleagues at the Anti-Corruption Foundation set up a regular delivery of books that could only be purchased through stores affiliated with the prison department. That's the rule in the Russian prisons. Many in prison preferred to read novels or detective stories, but not Navalny. Choosing between the latest novel by master spy thriller writer John Le Carré, Silverview, and Hillary Clinton's memoir about how and why she lost the 2016 election to Donald Trump, Navalny, in a phone call from court, he was in court, and I was flying from London to Moscow, and asked him, what do you want? What should I? Because I knew that at the time when I was going to land in Moscow, he was already be in jail, so I had to prepare ahead of time. So I said, ask him, what do you want? And he said, of course, Jenny Clinton, as if to say, why are you asking such idiotic questions? For his latest prison term, he was arrested upon his return from rehabilitation in Germany to Moscow in January 2021. He set up for himself the following goals. My prison self-education program currently has two main points: US domestic policy and B, China. I have been actively corresponding with a China expert. That's, his letter to me, right? I have been actively corresponding with a China expert since the first days of my imprisonment. I even set a goal for myself and him to become the most knowledgeable Russian politician about China. I even wanted to learn a little Chinese, but that's unrealistic here. I have a ton of books here about my Chai Kanshi. Oh, Chai Kanshi. What's the English for Chai Kanshi, by the way?
Okay.
Chai Kanshi. Sorry. In the same vein, he found for himself a consultant in theoretical physics while he was reading biography of Albert Einstein. I'm going to show you letters that he sent to me. We were in very correspondent. I will tell you how we did it, but later. That's all letters that the originals of the letters that he wrote to me. In another letter from Special Regime Colony Number 2 in Pokrov, it is the colony 3 hours east of Moscow by car. That was his initial correctional facility, described by lawyers as a breaking camp aimed at psychological pressure. There, Navalny went on hunger strike and was on hunger strike for 22 years. He almost died. So that's the translation. Thanks for the Nietzsche essay I sent him on advantages and disadvantages of history for life. Mind blowing. Remember, Josh, it was 1061. Nietzsche.
Explain.
Yes, it was in the course 1061 in grad school
Yes.
that we were supposed to, we had to take. Yeah, it was, a required course. So mind blowing. It is about us. Cross out Germans and write in Russians. When he, meaning Nietzsche, writes, Quote, we, the German people, are descendants. That exactly, end of quote, that exactly what Putin is doing to the country, condemning it to stagnancy through this enslavement to the archives, meaning to the Russian past and to the history of the Russian imperial glory, which has become the main and only ideology in Russia, writes Navalny. Reading the essays of German philosophers is difficult, of course, but powerful. I read them and regret dropping out of German class while in the university. You know, I don't understand how Russians read German philosophers in Russian. It's impossible. But, you know, in English, English translations are marvelous, you know, because I was able to compare. And you have to understand that political philosophy also didn't exist in the Soviet Union. You know, Gops was before the collapse of the Soviet Union, Hobbes was published in 1938, and that's it, and never since. Plato was censored all the way until the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, Aristotle's discourses, they were not published, only Prince was published. And so Nietzsche, of course, you know, Nietzsche didn't exist. Of course, you know, he was a fan, you know. So anyway, so political philosophy didn't exist. So before I proceed further with him getting education in his jails, let me tell you a little bit about Navalny's background, so that you appreciate what he was doing and what kind of willpower he had in order to make himself Navalny the way we knew him and admired him. He was born into a family of military lawyer. No, there was no lawyers. There were no lawyers in the Soviet Union. They were jurists, you know, sort of. This is his mom, Людмила Ивановна. This is his father, Anatoly Ivanovich. This is Alyosha, Alexei Navalny. And this is his younger brother, Oleg. I brought books, you know. This is Evgeny Feldman, you know, who was sort of, you know, his photo guy, you know, especially Navalny's campaign in 2018 when he was running for the president. You know, he published this book, you know, and last year it came to me all the way from, it published, of course, outside Russia. You cannot bring this to Russia because Navalny, even in his death, he's still terrorist and extremist, you know. His lawyers filed a case and asked to strip him, you know, because he's dead. And the response was no, he's still a terrorist and extremist. So you will be able to see these photos, and that's the book of his memoirs that is most interesting, you know, his diaries. And this book came in many, many languages and also in English. And of course, you know, I have it in Russian. And there are some photos you can pass around, you know, that Kirill, thank you, Kirill, producer of our series, you know, he printed out. So his father was Ukrainian and his mother Russian. Every summer, Navalny would visit his grandmother in Chernobyl. His grandmother, you know, had a it was a, you know, in the village near Chernobyl. She had a house there, where the family had a large house. His grandmother deeply despised the Soviet regime, considering it evil. She had survived the Holodomor, and for Navalny, these conversations became one of the earliest universities. The family lived, you know, because his father was a military guy. The family lived in a closed military town. There were about 60,000 such towns in the USSR. You couldn't just walk in or drive in, you know. You were supposed to receive a pass or a special invitation, and there were all kind of guards at the gates. So, as you can understand, guess, the schooling there reflected the environment. There were not all schools in the Soviet Union were public, and they were not exceptionally they were not exceptionally good. Alexei's mother, Lyudmila Ivanovna, she was an accountant, nevertheless made every effort to ensure that her children read Russian and Soviet classics and learned to distinguish good from evil, right from wrong. Navalny's weak school preparations prevented him from entering the judiciary department of Moscow State University. At that time, it was the best school in Russia. So instead, he enrolled at the Patrice-Lumumba University of Friendship of Peoples in southwestern Moscow. In his memoir, Patriot, Navalny writes with notable candor about the atmosphere at the People's Friendship University, particularly the law faculty, the judiciary faculty department, where academic assessments were commonly passed through gifts and bribes rather than merit. The university had a reputation as a place where virtually any kind of drug could be obtained, including hard drugs. It was early 1990s. During the Soviet era, students from the developing world studied there. This was one of the ways the USSR sought, often quite successfully, to build its soft power in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Navalny himself understood that he had serious gaps in his education, and that precisely, especially in political science and sociology. Thus, he put prison years to good use. Navalny read books by American and British politicians voraciously. He learned from them how to win elections. He read biographies and of Kennedy, Reagan, Thatcher, Clinton, Obama, Bush, Churchill. He read them in English. One can only guess how his press secretary, Kira Yarmush, managed to get books published in the hostile United States, how he managed to get them into prison through bookstores affiliated with the prison system. You understand? You couldn't just send a book to a prison, you know? You were supposed to do it through this special bookstore, which had the license from the Russian prison system to sell books to prisoners, to incarcerated people. The same is true for everything: food, you know, clothing. You can do it only through this special stores. You can do it online, and usually people, you know, the owners of the stores are, you know, the former police officers or people from the Russian prison system called FSIN. So that's why, once again, I don't know how they did it, but somehow they managed to bring books published in the United States through these bookstores in this Russian prison system, and that was delivered to Navalny. By the way, I remember sending a package with vegetables and fruit to Navalny in the Matrosky Tishina prison, that's the prison in Moscow, through a special prison store. It was already in 2020, which was often so. And once I received a letter from the owner of this prison store online, quote, "I respect Navalny and will not take money from you for shipping. I cannot do more than that, as you understand, but I want to support Alyosha," that's how they call him, "in this way at least," end of quote. In 2022, from Maximum Security Penal Colony K6 Melekhovo, Vladimir region, where he spent most of his time in the punishment cell, Navalny wrote to me, quote, "I decided to study and better understand American conservatives. Among the names of those he has been studying, Reagan, Thatcher, Bush, etc., was the name of Karl Rove, a famous American Republican Party operative and political technologist under George W. Bush Jr. I asked him in my reply letter, why do you need Rove? I use some, you know, Russian words. Why do you need Rove?" That's his in my newsroom. And that's one of our rallies. And it's Echo Moscow, studio of Echo Moscow, where I interviewed him. So, you know, I ask him, why do you need rope? And he answered to me, you are mistaken about Karl Rove. It is a very interesting book. But I understand that for an American liberal, it is similar to a book I don't know who to compare it to. By Surkov, it was the ideological operative in Putin's first and second administrations, an extremely cynical person, Surkov, or by Dugin, a Russian philosopher, a fascist, you know, one of, you know, Putin's, you know, lackeys. Navalny elaborated. From the point of view of understanding political dynamics and relations between conservatives and liberals, and more importantly, the struggle between different conservative discourses, it is very interesting and useful. That's what, you know, that's his letter in Russian. Now, imagine for a second a man who writes about conservative discourse in the United States is sentenced first to 9 years in jail in this court. I was the main witness on the defense side. It was a kangaroo court conducted inside the penal colony. There was a hole, you know, and you know, so it was inside the penal colony, and that's Navalny, that's his lawyer, Vadim Kobzev. He's in jail now. He was accused of taking part in terrorist organization which was created by Alexei Navalny. Three of his lawyers were sentenced to from 7 to 8 years in Russian penal colony for just for being Navalny's defenders. Even under Soviets didn't do that. Yes, you know, they made lawyers to leave, like, you know, there were several lawyers who defended dissidents. Dina Kaminska, you know, she had to leave the country. She defended those who came out on the Red Square in 1968. But, you know, they didn't imprison them. Only under Stalin, lawyers were imprisoned, attorneys were imprisoned. But under Stalin, everybody was in prison. So anyway, and then in a few months, in another in the maximum security prison, Navalny was sentenced to 19 years in the maximum security prison. And in this maximum security prison, he spent most of his time in the solitary confinement. This means solitary confinement in it is a 3 by 2 meter cell, a metal table and a stool bolted to the floor, a bunk bolted to the wall from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m., no hot water ever, one shower per week, freezing temperatures in the cell from October to April, a small window under the ceiling from which nothing but gray clouds can be seen, and stifling heat during the hot Russian summers. On top of everything else, this 47-year-old man, who was 190 centimeters, so it was 6'3", 6'2", 6'3", something like that. Yes, he was very tall. He was constantly starving. As punishment, he was forbidden from buying extra food in the prison store, commissary. It's called, you know, in the American prison, it's called commissary. And the prison food lacked any protein, and full of potatoes was full of potatoes and carbohydrate at the carbs. He never gets any vegetables or fruits, and he dreamed of an apple. On Sundays, he treated himself to a cup of instant coffee and white bread with butter. That was his treat. Of course, his prison cell was bugged and equipped with a video camera, and I really, you know, I imagined the scene. Putin was watching Navalny's life. That's my imagination, once again. Putin was watching Navalny's life, enjoying his torment, or ordering his lucky ones in epaulettes. He's sitting too comfortably. and then a life prisoner who doesn't and then they put a prisoner, another prisoner, in his small confinement. This prisoner didn't wash himself and urinates on himself. He was placed in Navalny's cell, and Navalny taught him to go to the toilet in a hole in the floor. It's called parasha. Wash himself, even brush his teeth. So, of course, it was real hard and bad. So Navalny wrote to me that he's in prison. That's how he looked. He wrote to me, "I'm fine. Even though it is a madhouse here, really, there is a psycho screaming outside the cell door. Weird music blaring from the speakers, or they are reading the internal prison rules. But I have gotten used to it. I can close my eyes and imagine I am in Barbados." I was writing to him from Barbados, where I went to get my American visas. Navalny always asked me to write the detailed account of my travels, and so that's what I did. And here you see, this is a stamp, проверено, verified, and this is Inspector Political Correspondent. That's a censor. All our letters went through the special censors. I wrote to him. So how we corresponded? At the beginning, the rule of the Russian prison, Zeka prisoners have the right to receive letters from their close ones. And to do it not through the mail, but that was the job of their lawyers. Knows that. Everybody knows that lawyers, one of the main job of a lawyer is to bring letters from Volia, from freedom. So for a while we were able to correspond. I was printing my letter. I corresponded with Khodorkovsky for 3 years like that, by the way. I was printing my letter in the computer and downloaded it on Signal to the account of one of his lawyers. I can say, I will explain to you why I'm so open about that later on. So, and to one of his lawyer printed out, because of course there was no internet, no access to any computers. Lawyers were supposed to leave their phones and all electronics behind the bars. And they put this in the other papers, and that's how Navalny was able to read. Exactly the same was Khodorkovsky. Unfortunately, it became impossible as of autumn 2022, because it became known that FSB Czechists, they put a video camera with which was able to enlarge texts in the selling of the cell where Navalny met with his lawyers, and they were filming everything. So it became totally impossible to do. So we corresponded from what is called, there is a special website, zona.ru. Correspondence is paid for by the sender for each page of the letter, for photographs, for everything. Also for blank sheets of paper for the addressee to write a reply on, because they were not they, there was no way to get paper in jail. Some sheets of paper given to Navalny were all smeared with black paint, as was the case when he wrote a reply to a letter from Kerry Kennedy, daughter of Robert Francis Kennedy, brother of assassinated President John Kennedy. The story was the following. Sometime in late autumn of 2022, I had a lunch with a colleague of mine from the New York Times, whom I had known since he was stationed in Moscow. We were talking about Navalny, and at some point I told him that Navalny got mesmerized by the biography of the late Robert Kennedy. And so apparently my American colleague told the story to Carrie Kennedy, daughter of Robert Kennedy. She suggested to end to she suggest she said, no, this is bad biography. I'm going to send Navalny right bio. And I had to explain that, Madam Kennedy, unfortunately, I don't think that your parcel with the right biography of Robert Kennedy was going to get to Navalny. I'm afraid that it will be lost somewhere in the mail. Then she suggested to write a letter to Navalny, and I became a postmaster. I copy-pasted her letter into mine, which I sent through official Zona Telecom. And those idiot censors, they just didn't realize that I was resending letters from some American. And so that's what she sent to Alexei Navalny. For Alexei Navalny, with deep admiration for your commitment to justice. Thank you for, of hope. Yes, for ripples of hope, Carrie Kennedy. And that's portrait of Robert Kennedy. And this portrait was in his cell. He kept it in his cell. It was amazing that he did it. But the most amazing was, of course, his response. So he wrote back in English, and oi. You see this black whatever spots? That's the kind of paper he got. And some of his letters, they came out. Letters they came out. It was impossible to read. They were all covered with this. With this black print or whatever, even though we paid for this, I paid for each and every sheet of paper. So he responded, and his short story about me and the book about RFK. Unfortunately, in Russia, we know quite little about him. Like he was a brother of the president and was dramatically killed too. I personally have known a bit more, but shame on me. Just some pieces of his bio. So, missile crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis. Jimmy Hoff's, I don't know who is Jimmy. Okay, and et cetera. So, once I was sitting in my punishment cell and reading the book, Believer by David Axelrod. How many people of you read the book by David Axelrod? He was the head, the chief of first Obama administration. I mean, now you know, but of course Navalny did because that was his education. So the book Believer by David Axelrod, Obama's chief strategist. Great, fantastic book. There is a cool moment in that book when Axelrod describes the exact moment when he decided that he wants to be in politics. When he was 5 or 6 years old, his aunt took him to your father's rally.
RFK is what
RFK,
they called Kennedy.
RFK, of course, was barnstorming NYC. Oh, what is it, NYC, by the way?
He was like
New York
campaigning in
City.
New York.
Okay, these days. And despite his young age, this boy absolutely thrilled and captured by RFK performance and the vibe of the crowd. So the author pictured this moment so great that I have decided I should know more about RFK. I mean, once again, just imagine the guy is sitting in solitary confinement. He's starving. These bastards not just didn't allow him to buy food from the commissary. But when they were putting him in a solitary confinement, the food that he ordered before his another punishment, that was a punishment to put, the so-called shuzo. I'm not going to explain to you, it's just too difficult, all the names. But anyway, he ordered the food. He was allowed to buy food for 9,000 rubles a month. It's approximately $90. So He was buying himself, some eggs, some milk, white bread. He ordered this before he was punished. Then he was put in the punishment cell for everything. He was put for punishment for everything. He didn't button up the way they wanted. He didn't say, anyway, it doesn't matter. So they brought this food to him. They showed this food to him, to the starving person, and then they dumped. And he was writing, he was explaining in this letter. I especially went to the maximum security prison in upstate New York. I wanted to know, and there were people, there was one guy who said, I killed 5 people. I spoke to people, to people who were, had, life sentence, 60 to life, 40 to life, and so. And they ask you, how often can you buy food from commissary every day? How much this? What do you buy? I have a cooker. I cook chicken, rice. And so. I don't want to say, I know I read a thing or two about, American prison. I understand it's not a sanatorium. It's not a, great place to be. But just, and they were allowed to see their wives every 3 months. Navalny was allowed to see his wife twice a year. Twice a year for 3 days. So that was his response. That's his, in one of his quotes.
And now
That he was
the end
done
is
after he
near.
was killed. That was his most
So
dramatic.
I say, the final curtain, my friend, I'll say it clear. I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I traveled each
That's his last.
and every
That was Hilda.
highway and more.
That's his
It's more
poem.
than this. I did it my way.
Unfortunately, this his response to Kerry Kennedy was the last exchange across the pond. Madam Kennedy, next letter never reached Navalny, as neither his response did. Census killed them. As they killed all the letters I sent to Navalny from the war-torn Ukraine, when I covered it on the ground, traveling Ukraine from Khmelnytsky in the west to Nikolaev, Kherson, Odessa in the southeast. Navalny's position on the, oh, by the way, Navalny's position on that abysmal war was well articulated in his court speeches and his public post on X. It is a war of aggression on part of Russia, which should return to, and Russia should return to 1991 borders, meaning deoccupying Crimea Peninsula, annexed in 2014, as well as those regions of Ukraine in the east, west, and in central Ukraine, which Putin's army conquered since 2014. Of course, eyes of the secret police on all things related to Navalny didn't allow us for frank discussion of Russian politics, though we argued sometimes heartedly about the reasons that Russia evolved into the aggressive, militaristic, fascist state. Navalny was very critical about corruption on the part of the Russian reformers. I tended to see the failure in institution building, in the failure of the institution building in Russia. But we had to be very careful not to leak anything that could have endangered people still present in Russia or in the Russian prisons across the country. In one of the letters, he wrote about mistakes that many Russian politicians made, he himself included, in giving primacy to building market economy at the expense of democratic politics and civil society, and exaggerating the role of business, big or small, in creating defending democratic fundamentals, as opposed to creating and defending democratic fundamentals. In another letter, he thought about the experience of countries from which the beautiful Russia of tomorrow, that was the slogan of his group, those nations can benefit, those nations which went through dictatorships and autocracies and who managed to get out and build a decent, rule-based and safe life for their citizens, like Chile, Taiwan, South Korea. We discussed this extensively. Finally, there were one more group of books which he read in order to understand how to survive the hardships of the Russian prison system and not to betray neither your morals nor your beliefs. He was reading memoirs by South African Nelson Mandela, Soviet Jewish activist and prisoner Natan Sharansky, and the Soviet time human rights activist Alexander Podrobinsky. He wrote, "Nothing has changed. Everything is just as it was in the Soviet Gulag. The same punishment with cold and hunger, the same endless solitary confinements, mental hospitals, and prison-like cells." Natan Sharansky, the former Soviet the prisoner in the Soviet Union from 1977 to 1986, wrote a letter to Navalny in jail. Sharansky himself withstood deprivation, torture, and 400 days in solitary confinement, including a 110-day-long hunger strike. Having been given a Russian language copy of Sharansky's 1988 memoir, Fear No Evil, which he read in prison, Navalny, who spent nearly 300 days in solitary confinement during his last prison term, wrote to the former refusenik to express his admiration and gratitude. Quote from Sharansky: "It was clear he was really being pressed by punishment. I think that Putin always had this idea that he has to kill him, so they tried to kill him through punishing him. And so all his spirit at this moment, all his fighting spirit, I felt it very, very strongly in his letters," Sharansky said in after Navalny was killed. And one more quote from Sharansky. Especially, this quote to those who keep asking why Navalny dared to return back to Russia after he was poisoned and survived. Quote, when he, Navalny, expressed his views that, quote from Navalny, "Reading your book makes me optimistic," it was clear that it is not optimism about his own survival. His optimism was about the results of the struggle. So I think he remained optimistic to the last moment, but not about his own life. He definitely understood that the moment your only aim, that at that moment the only aim is not to survive. The only if you make it the goal of your life to survive, then you're finished. You are not fighting anymore. The last message I got from Navalny was when he landed in the Polar Penal Colony in the Arctic town Harp. There was no electronic post mail available, paper letters only with a duration of several weeks to several months each way. I wrote to him a detailed report on the state of the presidential elections in the United States, data, polls, predictions, analysis. He was extremely interested in that. I had always, and I was writing him about gubernatorial elections, municipal elections. Sometimes I covered elections here just to write to him in jail. I don't know if my letter ever had gotten to him. I got a quick note from him on February 9, a week prior to his murder. For some reasons, he was left without a lawyer for several days of his last week. There was a rule among Russian human rights lawyers: if your defendant is in punishment cell or solitary confinement, you better visit his penal colony each day so that his prison guards knew that the Zakai prisoner was under control of his lawyers. It's just simply harder to kill somebody if there is unwanted witness around. But Navalny was alone, and he was killed the day the Munich Security Conference opened. A few weeks before Alexei's murder, I had a dream. It was frighteningly real. Somehow I managed to get to Navalny's labor camp, get him out, and we were driving with him in the old Soviet sedan, Zhiguli. Navalny was dressed in prison uniform, and he asked me, "Zhenya, where are we going?" "I don't know," I responded, and that's when I woke up. And the last, that's the letter that I got from him at the very beginning of his ordeal in March 2021 from the Moscow prison 99/1. He wrote, Jenny, you found something to cry about. Everything is okay. Historical process. Russia goes through it, and we go along with it. We'll get there, probably. I'm doing fine, and I don't regret anything, and you should not. And do not be upset. Everything is going to be fine. And even if it does not, we will be consoled by the fact that we were honest people. Hugs, March 2021. So, yeah, you know, at least, you know, we were honest people. We tried to fight, we lost. But Navalny was going to be an example for generations to come of somebody who believed in common good and believed of the beautiful Russia of tomorrow. Thank you. Oh.
Last year is when I was freelancing remotely for the Associated Press to cover the war mostly. But anyway, I want to ask you just two questions. One, recently it's come out more and more evidence that the Havana syndrome is stems from Russian weapon by using pulse microwave weapon. I wondered, and you mentioned at the beginning of your talk about the blog toxin used to assassinate Navalny in jail. Is there more to it, these special ops, like I think it's called Kamita, going back to Lenin's days, the office that he developed, the special ops to develop assassination means that could not be detected. Is there a lot more of that we don't know about Russian dissidents or in the West who have been assassinated? And just the other question is about the swap. There have been a lot of reports that Navalny was about to be exchanged for Russian citizens jailed in Western countries, including the assassin in Berlin. Forget his name right now. Those two questions.
Thank you. With respect to, yes, there was a special lab, and there is a lab. There was so-called eighth main directorate, which had, that was the directorate in charge of creating all kind of cryptography, technical stuff, all this, James Bond stuff, So, and there was this lab poison, which was especially effective during Stalin's years when, they were poisoning members of the Russian emigre community, as predominantly in France. And of course, and it exists, and they keep developing all kind of poisons. I never investigated this, this case with respect to poisoning, not poisoning, but there is something with the radio waves against people in American consulate and embassies. I read what was written about that. I know the guy who did the investigation. So he absolutely aware that it did happen. I saw his interview to 60 Minutes. And I think it was very convincing. And just lately, as far as I understand, just lately, I don't remember State Department or Intelligence Council, they said that there is something to that because, for quite a while, CIA didn't recognize those facts. I have no idea, and no, I don't know anything more about that. As with respect to exchange, yes, he was supposed to be exchanged for the Putin's personal assassin, Makhnatkin. No, not Makhnatkin. Makhnat was a different. All of a sudden, just slipped out of my mind. The guy who was in German prison. There was problems with German authorities. They didn't want to because the guy killed assassined. Some Chechen dissident on the territory of Germany. And so he was sentenced to life in prison, and he spent 2 or 3 years in prison. And so German authorities didn't want to give him up. And by the way, some American journalists, for instance, David Hoffman, they considered that it was a wrong way to go do because that gives a wrong message to Putin. He will start killing people and then exchange them for Americans who were sitting in Russian jails and etc. Now there were talks about I myself, I spoke with Angela Merkel, asking her to help, to do this exchange, and a lot of people in the Biden's State Department and Biden's White House, they were involved in an attempt to do this prisoner swap.
Your name was
Krasikov, of course. Krasikov, thank you so much. Krasikov, yes. Krasikov, it was he was personal Putin's assassin, and Putin promised him that whatever, that he always was going to bring him back to Russia. It was Putin's promise. So, he has, admirations for these people. So, to be honest with you, I think it there were a lot of talks that Navalny was killed right before the swap. The problem is that to kill somebody like Navalny in jail, it's not something that you do overnight. First of all, you have to receive okay from Putin himself. The history of Russian Soviet political assassination suggests that no assassin, whether we're talking about Судoplatov, or others, these famous Russian assassins, no one would ever fulfill the order unless it comes from the very top. That's what Судoplatov, the famous Soviet assassin, wrote in his letter to Nikita Khrushchev. They were always, and the same was true with respect to Brezhnev, when Todor Zhivkov asked Russia, Soviets to help to kill Bulgarian dissident Georgi Markov, and that was and General Kalugin, the famous General Kalugin, was in charge of this whole operation, and he was killed with a poison in London. So first of all, Putin had to okay this. Secondly, this kind of orders, they had to go, they have to go only through one chain of command, only FSB. Only, because they don't trust anybody else. They consider that everybody else are going to, and you see that a lot of information came out, by the way, the whole fact that, that it was possible to take Navalny's biological materials from his corpse. That allowed to do this lab work. So then it took 20 days to take Navalny from his maximum security prison in Vladimirsky Oblast to penal colony Kharkiv in Arctic. So I'm telling you all that it is that several months before that, Putin's people got the order to get rid of Navalny. I don't know how he said this. Most likely said, "Он мне так надоел." That was enough. So, was there a possibility? Some people say that, I believe that it was the possibility. I thought that he was not going to kill him, to be honest with you. I thought that Navalny was too well known to kill him, to be honest with you. So anyway, so I thought that there was a chance. Unfortunately, it was dragging and dragging and dragging. Germans, Americans, Biden was slow, Sullivan was slow, and it was unfortunate. Yes, please.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I just wanted to ask you about if you have any updates about the status of Navalny's main organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Is it active at all? Is it possible for it to be effective in any way if it is active? And then just what do you think that Navalny's legacy will be?
I think that the main Navalny legacy is I'm not afraid, and you shouldn't be afraid too. That's extremely important. We are people of the country where people were oppressed for centuries, where there was always this omnipotent state, and it didn't allow for people to understand themselves as citizens. All the way until 1991, until peace. So this idea, don't be afraid, extremely powerful. His book is his legacy. His legacy is his legacy. As for the Anti-Corruption Foundation, some people are in jails. The absolute majority are in Vilnius, in Lithuania. They keep producing their investigations. They keep, they're doing, you know, some of them good, some of them not very good. They keep working. Yulia Navalny announced that she's going to run for president of Russia. And he's trying to become sort of a leader of the Russian opposition. So she's not very successful. But, you know, it's hard. You know, he was extremely important when Navalny was alive. They were, you know, they were, I always kept saying that, you know, Alexei Navalny is not one person, two people. There are two people, two persons, Alexei Navalny and Yulia Navalny. She was extremely important for him as a discussant, as supporter, as somebody who kept his back, for somebody who kept the family intact, you know, who took care about children, etc. Anyway, I don't know what's going to happen to them. Unfortunately, you know, it's hard to be in immigration. It's very hard, and many of us who want to be badly want to be back. I dream about my place in Moscow. It's not, you know, it's not clear, you know. But, you know, when I think about returning back to Moscow, I ask myself, wait a second, I'm returning back to Moscow, but there is no Alexei Navalny. So what are we going to do? You know, he was such an important figure. He was our hope. You know, he projected the strength. He supported, you know, whenever I was sometimes, you know, I was crying my letters to him, you know. And he was trying to, you know, sort of to say, no, Jane, what are you talking about? You know, do this, do that. You know, when I started my YouTube channel, he wrote to me a letter of 23 pages. 23 pages long letter, handwritten, telling me how to do my YouTube. Because, you know, he was so good. He had, you know, millions of subscribers. His, you know, investigation of Putin's palace got a viewership of 180 million people, you know. So he wrote me step by step what I have to do, except that, you know, I don't have his charisma and many other things. So, but it is just to say that that's all his legacy. Whether the Anti-Corruption Foundation will be able to keep his, I don't know. I don't know, it's hard. They, you know, for them, it was very traumatic event, you know, and I think they're still trying to find their place without knowing. Yes, Rory.
So I have two different questions. First question, can you explain to us why Putin was so keen poisoning Navalny as opposed to the way Nemtsov was killed, the way Prigozhin was killed, and he's murdered a lot of people in old-fashioned ways. Why, what was the importance of poison? My second question, following on from the previous question, is so Maria Pevchik put out a big investigation after Navalny's death, which where she argued basically that Putin was the direct descendant of the reformers of the 1990s, and that Yeltsin and Gibson family were as responsible for Russia in its current form as anyone else. So I'm interested in how you think about that Navalny argument.
Thank you, Robert. I will start with your second question. Maria Pevchik did, you know, this series of documentaries, stuff like that, which was titled Traitors, Predatели. And this series was devoted to reformers, who established market economy in Russia. And they supported the first democratically elected president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin. And some of them brought Putin into power. There are a lot of factual mistakes. I wrote extensively, I tried to, because first of all, I lived at that time, whereas she was either young or she was outside the country. Secondly, you know, I was writing a lot about that. So there were a lot of factual mistakes. I do think that reformers made a lot of mistakes. But the major mistakes was that they kept KGB intact. You can't reform, you can't turn Russia into a democratic country if you sustain its Gestapo. Just imagine for a sec, you know, Germany after World War II. You know, and you keep Gestapo intact. You keep people, you keep generals. And what is much more important, you keep institutional culture, organizational culture, and institutional legacy. Wait a second, you know, how are you going to deal with that? Two most successful reforms of regimes happened under Bolsheviks, which changed Tsarist bureaucracy in a matter of 10 years, 98%, and Hitler, who immediately changed the Weimar Republic, Kaiser bureaucracy and Weimar Republic. The Weimar Republic, you know, totally failed to do anything with bureaucracy. And reformers never did it. Why? I asked Georgi Budweis, one of the key guys at the first Yeltsin administration. He was state secretary. I asked him, why didn't you do? Why didn't you dissolve? It was the whole possibility to open our hands, to bring out all this dirty stuff that of communists and Soviets, and just to bring justice to people, you know, to their families, to their descendants. And he said, you know, it was so boring training. It was fucking boring to them. There was a theoretical sort of, you know, foundation for that, which was outlined in Adam Przeworski's famous book, Democracy and the Market. Market. You know, institutions come next. And remember, Przeworski wrote that that people, famous Helmholtz Jacob, that, you know, as a result of the reforms, first it will become very bad. So life will be very bad in post-communist countries before it becomes any better. This is famous Jacob. So, and according to Przeworski, as a result of this burden of reforms and an impossibility for people to survive those very hard reforms, military people will come into power on the backs of the mob. So that was the theory. And this theory was very, very successful, you know. Russian reformers, they were writing exactly about it. Schleicher. Andrew Schleicher, Harvard University professor, was one of those who was also, you know, was writing, and there was this famous book about, you know, the stakeholders and etc. Choosing between KGB guides and people on the streets. Chubais time and again kept saying, all people will come out on the street. No one told us they're not going to come. There were no political mobilization whatsoever, you know, the entire 90s, after 1993, this attempt to pull in the so-called Russian parliament. Reformers were afraid of people, understandably, and they believe that exactly the way Przeworski wrote, that people were not going to tolerate the burden of the reform, they were going to come out on the streets, and that's it. So they decided that they need KGB in order to conduct surveillance over communists and all the, you know, nationalist organizations, etc. They consciously chose institutions of the old regime in order to build the new one, Tocqueville. I'm citing the beginning of Tocqueville's book on the French Revolution. You can't build something new out of the debris of the old. And that's exactly what they tried to do. Why? Because they were ignorant idiots. No, I'm sorry, to Rory. I'm sorry, they were extremely ignorant. They knew something about market economy. But no one of them lived abroad. No one knew anything. Political science didn't exist. They didn't know anything about institutions. They didn't understand this, you know? So, and they didn't study it with Peter Hall, as we did. So, but now, there are just factual mistakes. So, with respect to Boris Yeltsin, he wanted the then Minister of Railroads, you know, guy that was back then they were in the uniforms, you know, he was he didn't like Putin. Chubais didn't want Putin. In fact, when Chubais was the president of the head of the presidential administration, and Putin just lost elections, you know, his patron Sobchak lost elections in St. Petersburg. Chubais refused to take him in the administration. He said, Vova, I don't have space for you. His name was Vova. There was the whole department which was in charge of the former Soviet property, if you remember. And Putin was accepted to take care about Soviet property abroad, predominantly in Germany, where there was a lot of Soviet property. And nobody knew who was using this, who was selling this, who was renting out this, and etc. So to cut a long story short, Chubais didn't want Putin. He was in favor of Stepashin, the guy, you know, also in uniform, because there was a belief that after Drunken Yeltsin, there should be some strong man. And they were publishing stories about Pinochet. They were looking for the Russian Pinochet. Yeah. But there was Alexander Voloshin, and there was Tatiana, Yeltsin's daughter, and Yeltsin's son-in-law, who was the head of the presidential post, one of the key guys in Yeltsin administration. And they wanted Putin. Why? I can give you an example. I came to Alexander Voloshin, the then chief of the presidential administration, to speak precisely about, I said, now, what are you doing? Don't you understand that it's not just one KGB guy who's coming into power? It's the whole corporation that's going to come into power. He wrote him on paper. I was speaking out loud, but he knew that he was back, of course. And so he wrote me on the piece of paper. Мы полностью его контролируем. What can you do with people who believe that they can control a KGB guy? Who doesn't understand the structure? It's a brother thing. So you cannot control the operation. Stalin couldn't. So that's number one. And, you know, unfortunately, you are not going to read in the Pevchuk investigation or see this in Pevchuk investigation and, you know, and blame that, you know, their market reforms were wrong. You know, they were, you know, somebody said they were better Marxists than Marx himself, even Russian reformers. They can't believe, you know, there was the belief that all they had to do is to build the market economy, and then because of the market economy, there will be different interests, and different interests will create different political preferences, different political parties, and so on. So that's why. And so, and your first question was?
Poison.
Poison. Why poison? They tried to conceal. You know, now we understand that several people were killed by poison in London. Business people, you know, several of them. The only country where Putin yet to kill his opponent is the United States of America. We don't understand why. So, why poison? Because, the first time they tried to do it with Polonyi, It wasn't their success. They were trying different, you know, with Litvinenko, with the former KGB agent in London, who was poisoned the following. It was done very inadvertently, and, you know, one of the guys who, one of the assassins, Kofkov, died in Germany. Yeah, because he was also, you know, got this, this was a radioactive material, and apparently there were traces all around the Great Britain, so they realized. No, no. Radioactive materials is not good to kill your enemies. So then they turned to Novichok. Now, I spoke with the guy who created Novichok. Yeah, you know, that it was very difficult. And one of them scared to kill. So nobody, when Novichok was created 3 decades ago, nobody intended to use it against single person. It was intended for the battlefield to throw a grenade with Novichok and then everybody around it. Person. The problem is that it's very, Novichok gets out of your blood, of your body very quickly. The version with which Navalny was killed was supposed to get out in 48 hours. That's why Putin allowed to get Navalny out. They were absolutely aware. There was an interview with the guy from, you know, the charge of the lab of the Bundeswehr, and he explained that just, you know, 7 months before that, they managed to get the samples of this new Navalny. So spectrometer, I don't know what's the English for that, spectrometer in Moscow, the best spectrometer in Moscow, which tested Navalny blood, didn't show any trace. And so Russians were absolutely aware. The Germans were not going to trace it. They didn't know that Bundeswehr had one first better spectrometer, and then they had, you know, the samples of this new version of Navalny. Why? Because it's very easy, Rory. If Navalny didn't get to Germany, he would be dead, and everybody would be speculating. You know, did he had some alcohol before he goes, or did he eat something? Was it a food poison, or like, you know, just, you know, we just, you know, recently, you know, I read the 200 pages of his official medical expertise, you know, after his death, so Russians did. You know, basically, you know, he had bad heart. Whoa! He had bad heart. Bad heart. Then, you know, he had something in his liver. And he had hypertonia. What is it? Hypertension? Hypertension. They were absolutely aware that nobody was going to discover traces of these. And when you, нет трупа, нет преступления, no body, no crime. And you can suspect, you know, Putin killed, but you know, that's why it's so important that now we have, you know, the conclusion of 5 independent, independent from each other labs, who confirmed that he was poisoned with this, you know, Ecuadorian drug. But, you know, it was synthesized. Now we know that it was synthesized. Because otherwise, you know, he kept saying, look, you know, Putin kept saying all these years, he kept saying that, you know, that we didn't do that. He just died. He just died. You know, don't we kill too, said Donald Trump. You know, so that's why so it was so important. Because you couldn't point to that. And judging by what we know about Russian assassins, and we know a lot about, you know, I did several lectures on that, about we know about Soviet assassins, there is special procedure with respect to, even nowadays, there's special procedure who gives orders, how you give orders, who there is. What kind of institute is in charge, what kind of department is in charge, and so on. I'm sorry that I'm so winded in answering your question.
So Will, I'm going to take the chair's privilege here and ask the last question.
Okay.
Thank you, because We're almost pushing 2 hours here, so this is the last one. You were at the Civic Courage Prize together when he was given, when Navalny was given in absentia the Civic Courage Prize, and there was a presentation, the video that you showed here, the CNN documentary that came out, and afterwards, the discussion that we had in my family about when we came home from that event was this decision to go back to Russia and to get back on that plane from Germany after he got better and to go back to Russia. And, you know, that's not a decision a lot of people would have made. And I wonder if in your final closing thoughts here, you can offer any insight that you might have had personally from talking to him about that decision to go back. And if not, based on what you knew of him, if you could just sort of shed a little more light on, you know, what was potentially going through his head at that time. Because when his story is told to people who know Russia, there's lots of details and there's lots of, you know, all we get into all of these details. But when his story is told to people who don't know Russia, who just watch that documentary, and the people who just like learn about Navalny, I think in the long term, when people learn about Navalny, part of that legacy will be that decision to go back back from Germany. And so I just thought maybe in your closing thoughts, you could say just a little bit about that moment and that decision.
George, thank you very much. To be honest with you, I think that it was so natural for Navalny to return back. I wouldn't expect him to do anything else. But we did speak about that when he was in Germany. And I asked him, what are you going to do? And he said, of course I'm going to return. I said, you know, there are going to be a couple of problems. You know, they probably will put you in jail. And he said, it doesn't matter. When you read his Patriot, and we also spoke about that, he first of all, he believed that Putin wouldn't dare to put him in jail. He was so, after this poison, after their investigation, after they tracked down, you know, the guy who put poison in his underwear, you know. Navalny was absolutely aware that Putin was not going to put him in jail. And there was no real basis. They put him in jail first on the basis that he didn't come to see his patrol officer, and he didn't come to see his patrol officer in Moscow because he was in Germany recovering after coma. So, and his attorney, Olga Mikhailova, she's in Paris now, she told him, Alyosha, they're going to put you in jail. I said, okay, you know, if I have to... Then he didn't expect that. Secondary, he thought that he was going, you know, that he was probably going to spend, you know, several years and then maybe he will get out. He realized that most likely he was going to be dead, that they're going to kill him sometime later. And sort of, you know, he told Yulia, last time Yulia saw him, visited him, it was July of 2022. And he told her that let's be realistic. Even if it's going to be, even if the change of regime happens, most likely they're going to kill me before then. And each of us, we have to live our own lives. That what, you know, he cited in his book, Patriot. But at the same time, you know, he, you know, for instance, in our exchange, he was constant. He was writing to me, Zhenya, do you really think that I expect Putin to put me in jail for 5 years? Of course, you know, I'm going to sit in jail until Putin is alive. He believed that, you know, so that, you know, this war in Ukraine, that this is that. Those billionaires who run Russia now, they're not going to tolerate this war. They wouldn't want to lose their property outside the country, their yachts, their billionaires, their accounts, and etc. So, no, and finally, the most important thing What was he going to do in exile? What? Govern, what he, you know, look at all our, you know, so-called leaders of the Russian opposition. They lost. It's, you know, you cannot, Navalny believe that he was a Russian politician and his place was with the Russian people. And I think he was absolutely right. You cannot be a Russian politician and fight for the for good of your people from outside. And he made his choice.
On that note, please join me in thanking Zhenya for her presentation.